You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, November 11th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, guys. How are you doing tonight?
Quite well.
Super.
Good.
We have a great interview with Gerald Posner coming up later in the show about the JFK assassination. Can't wait to get to that.
Can't wait for that one, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder how it ends.
And what better time to go back to the 60s than on the day that LSD was first synthesized? Marvin. Happy LSD Day, everybody.
LSD Day?
What does LSD have to do with the 60s?
Everything, man.
Tune in, drop out, and something else.
I was only five.
Although, I mean, it was first synthesized in the 30s, so... it was in 1938, November 16th, 1938, Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann created LSD. He wasn't trying to get high. He was looking for a thing to help people's respiration.
Help them breathe?
An analeptic. He was looking for an analeptic, a respiratory and circulatory stimulant. Mm. And so he ended up synthesizing LSD, which stands for lysergic acid diethylamide. And it didn't do what he wanted it to do. He set it aside and sort of forgot about it for several years. It wasn't until April 16th, 1943, that he took another look at it. And while he was messing around with it, he accidentally got a little bit on his skin, ended up tripping balls, as the kids say.
Now, did he enjoy it, though? That's the first question.
He enjoyed it so much that 3 days later, on April 19th, he purposefully ingested a quarter of a milligram, 250 micrograms, which at the time he predicted to be a threshold dose. He was off by one order of magnitude. The threshold dose is only 20 micrograms, but he took 250 micrograms and, about an hour later, he started freaking out and he had to go home from the lab. But because there was a war on, the transportation options were limited. And so all he had was a bicycle. So his assistant helped him ride home on a bike while he was tripping.
At 10 times the dose.
Yeah. And because of that, April 19th is known as Bicycle Day. And is celebrated the world over by people who appreciate chemistry and / or tripping balls. Hofmann, even though he took a whole lot of LSD, both the first couple of times and on and off for almost the rest of his life, he said he gave it up in his later years, but he took a lot of LSD and he fervently believes that it had really great uses, especially in terms of psychiatric uses or just allowing people to sort of come to grand realizations about their place in the universe and all of that good stuff. And, but despite that he sounded like an absolute hippie, he remained a prominent and successful chemist, throughout his life. He maintained his high-ranking position in Switzerland as a chemist, even though he continued to trip. And he lived to 101 years old. He ended up dying of a heart attack when he was 101. So, okay.
Whoa, 101. That's a great age. Well, yeah. Good for him. I don't recommend people do it because I think it's dangerous, but you know, if you're going to do it, just don't ride a bike.
Yeah, it's definitely not recommended that you go bike riding after
operate heavy machinery.
If you're a major league pitcher, you can throw a shutout like Doc Ellis did.
Really?
Yeah, Doc Ellis, major league pitcher.
A shutout.
Good for him.
Wow. So, Jay, 101 years is pretty old, you know, for a human, but it's not close to the oldest animal to ever live.
No, the question is, what's the oldest animal ever recorded? And I think I know. I saw an old guy the last time I was
Joan
in Florida.
Rivers.
Yeah, it was either Joan Rivers or that
a little
the,
late.
The guy I saw in Florida when I was going to a movie theater. I, you know, you ever see someone, you're like, oh my God, like you could still walk and you're, wow, good for you. But, sorry, old guy, you're not the oldest animal ever recorded, whoever you are. But in the fall of 2006, a team of researchers were on an Icelandic expedition and they found an ocean quahog, which are also called the Arctica Icelandica bivalve mollusks. Thank you. In the seabed. So they originally thought it was approximately 405 years old, but they were using it at the time, a method that wasn't as accurate as something, another method that they came up with later, which was counting the rings. And it, you know, it's complicated and you should definitely read about it, but it is very interesting that it's similar to the way a tree is where they can read or count the rings that grow on the shell.
Yeah. Dendrochronology.
And what they found was that their original estimate was off by over 100 years. So they estimate now that it's about 507 years old. So this same mollusk that they found beat the world record twice, the first time they found it and then when they remeasured it. Paul Butler at Bangor University in Wales told Science Nordic that we got it wrong the first time and maybe we were a bit hasty publishing our findings back then, but we are absolutely certain that we've got it the age right now. So this dates the mollusk back to the year 1499. And guys, think of Leonardo da Vinci testing his flying machine and Michelangelo was carving David and Amerigo Vespucci was mapping the sky at that time. You know, we're going back like so far that we're in a completely different world. Sadly, the British researchers who found it killed it. Did you guys realize that?
They stepped on it?
Well, no, they were opening.
They dissected it. Yeah.
Yeah, they took over 200 Jeez. Samples. They opened it up. They're like, oh, okay, they're you know, testing it for a lot of different things. But, you know, then when they tested its age, they were like, whoa, are you kidding? Like, this thing is incredibly old. So, of course, that was sad, but you know, in the end, you know, that's science and it, you know, science kills everything that it rolls over. Everybody knows that.
It's clear. I could see they opened it up and they
thought of it that way.
They realized what they'd done and they were like, oh, wait, let's just put this back and hope nobody notices.
Now, maybe because they felt bad or whatever, they ended up giving the mollusk, you know, calling her Ming after the Ming dynasty because that was another thing that was going
Flash
on.
Gordon.
500 years ago, yeah.
Ming the Merciless.
So what they did was the updated version they used several methods to age it, but one of the big ones was a geochemical method called carbon-14, which I'm sure many of you have heard about. And they said that they are confident that they are within 2 years of the exact age. The question is, how come the animal can live so long? Anybody have any ideas?
Because it's a clam?
LSD?
No telomeres?
Because it hides and it doesn't get eaten by other animals.
Because it doesn't get cancer.
All right. So it's because they have an incredibly slow metabolism and genetics, combination of the two. I guess we're all used to slow creatures living a long time like tortoises, right? I personally think that it's relative laziness. So tortoises and mollusks.
Oh, that's your plan for living long, Jay.
Yes, thank you.
It's all coming together now.
To be a lazy bastard. I'm going to live forever. So on an interesting side note, glass sponges are estimated to live how long, guys? Any idea?
I've read different things about that, including 10,000 years.
Yeah, with my research that I did, it was 15 to 23,000 years.
Yeah, sponges can live a long time. I'm trying to verify that absolutely.
Yeah, well, different researchers say different things, Steve.
Yeah.
But in the end, it's a long-ass time. I'll take 1,000 years. I'll take 1,000.
I'll take that for 1,000.
Other than sponges, which are, they're animals, the only animals that are not metazoans. Is that how it works? So the longest, the oldest metazoan, I guess, is the clam.
Yeah. But I'd like to know what the oldest mammal is, though.
The oldest mammal?
Is it, you know, how long do elephants live? How long do tortoises live?
Well tortoises aren't mammals,
sweetie.
What? Really?
Tortoises are reptiles. Turtles, snakes, lizards, and crocodilians.
I don't know. I always just picture them as mammals, like, because they're so fucking cute. Oh, shit. Yeah, forget it.
You kind of wanted to adopt them into our mammalian family, right?
That's not as bad, though, as my mother-in-law thinking that rhinoceroses were dinosaurs.
Whoa.
I know, right?
I think that's fair.
What?
Have you seen a rhinoceros?
They're epic up close.
There's an O and an I. Oh,
what are you talking about?
No, they have the same letter, so it's just kind of...
Okay. Well, speaking of DNA, you guys, I'm sure, have heard of junk DNA.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. A bit controversial in that the question is, how much of the genome is comprised of junk DNA? Meaning DNA that's not doing anything, it's just cluttering up our genome.
So how much junk is in the trunk?
Yeah, how much junk is in our genetic
trunk? I'm gonna guess 15%
is junk.
Yeah, that's my guess.
Wow. Okay, more than that. Hold on to that. Anyone else want to guess?
Yeah, like 93%.
Yeah, I was gonna go with 95.
80 to 85.
You're all wrong.
What?
But we'll get to that in a second.
But who is the least wrong?
Yes. That's but it depends on who you talk to. So, all right, here's the thing. DNA, what's uncontroversial is that only about 1.2% of the base pairs in human DNA are coding DNA, meaning that they code for proteins. The rest, the other 98.8%, is non-coding DNA. Now, we know that some of that non-coding DNA has other functions.
Are those introns?
Well, there's all sorts of things. There's introns, there's regulatory sequences, you know, the parts of the DNA that regulate the transcription of the coding sequences, of the sequences that get turned into proteins. So, I mean, it was never believed that all of non-coding DNA was non-functional. We knew that there had to be some regulatory sequences in there. The question always has been, well, how much of the genome is regulatory? And what are all the different ways in which the non-coding DNA is regulating the genome? And of course, not surprisingly, over the years, we've learned new stuff about DNA and we have filled in, you know, gaps in our knowledge. So the portion of the DNA, of the non-coding DNA, that's considered non-functional, i.e. junk, has shrunk as we discovered new stuff that it's doing, right? The junk has shrunk. Not surprising.
That happens to me a lot.
For example, some of the things that the non-coding DNA does, it regulates the transcription of DNA. It also regulates the DNA splicing. So one gene can actually be spliced multiple different ways to generate different proteins. And of course, the non-coding regulatory parts of the DNA are responsible for that. In fact, there was a recent study which found that is a new way in which DNA is regulated. They found that even distant sites on the DNA can regulate how mRNA is spliced. Previously, it was only described that adjacent sites on the DNA. So again, that further extends by a little bit the amount of the non-coding DNA that is functional and not junk. Now, here's the thing I find incredibly annoying, and that is every time some researcher publishes a study that finds some new wrinkle or angle to regulatory DNA, the press release has some headline similar to the one for the news item I just mentioned called Unjunking Junk DNA, or, you know, it's not junk after all, or the myth of junk DNA, or they basically are saying, since we've discovered some little thing that one tiny percentage of the DNA does, the whole concept of junk DNA is wrong. And it's bullshit. It's totally misleading. Of course, the creationists are all over this because junk DNA is evidence for evolution. Yeah. And so now they talk about the incredible shrinking junk DNA. And, you know, one article talks about the junk of the gaps, you know, which is clever. So what they're saying is that it's like the vestigial organ argument, because, you know, junk DNA in a way is vestigial, that we don't know what it does, and therefore we assume it's non-functional. So it's an argument from ignorance. And you know what? That is not true. That is not true. I mean, it's partly true in that, you know, we don't know what it does, and we may discover a function for parts of the non-coding DNA, which we have been doing over the years. But there's a completely independent and positive line of argument of evidence for how much of the genome is non-coding. I mean, how much of the non-coding genome is non-functional and therefore junk. Right. Do you guys know what that is?
No.
It is conservation. So conserved segments of DNA over evolutionary time means that if we look at a human DNA and mouse DNA, that this little strip of the DNA is the same.
Can't be junk.
A 100% conserved segment of DNA means that it's identical, right, over that period, whatever comparison we're making between a human and a mouse or human and a turtle, right, because turtles are reptiles, not mammals, right, Jay? Or
exactly.
Humans and whatever. And 100% non-conserved would be that it's accumulating mutations at the background mutation rate with absolutely no negative pressure against accumulating new mutations. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then things may be somewhere in between. They may be partially conserved. There's some negative selective pressure against mutations, but some mutations are allowed. So we've done this research. We've compared the DNA or among multiple species, humans, mice, and others. And we've come up with an estimate that about 90% of the human genome has absolutely zero conservation, has zero negative selective pressure against mutations. And therefore, it seems to be non-functional. Further, geneticists argue that we have 50 years of research showing a very tight correlation between the degree of conservation and functionality. So that is not an assumption that non-conserved regions are non-functional. We've actually demonstrated that over years of genetics research. So the evidence all lines up to the argument that 90% of the genome is junk DNA. 10% is functional. 1.2% is coding. The other 8.8% is regulatory. That's probably the best synopsis that we could say at this time. We're still sorting out exactly what the regulatory stuff is doing. It's very interesting, but, you know, about 90%, I think, is the best current estimate of the genome is junk DNA by the conservation line of argument. Now, here's the genuine scientific controversy, not the fake creationist controversy. The genuine controversy is the ENCODE project, E-N-C-O-D-E. They were using data from the Human Genome Project, looking to see if they could find functionality in the non-coding regions of DNA. And they claim to have found functionality in most of the non-coding DNA. Like 50%, 80% of the, depending on, you know, which study you're looking at within that ENCODE project. The defenders of the ENCODE position, including John Maddock, I think is the big guy who's defending that position, say that they challenge the line of argument that I just laid out for you, but I don't think he makes any valid points. You know, saying that we're just assuming non-conserved equals non-functional. No, but we have good reasons to think that non-conserved are non-functional. For example, also they make the argument that if that 90% of the genome that is apparently junk, if they could demonstrate that it's doing anything, then they equate that to functional. You see that?
Yeah.
You see how that could be problematic?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the same kind of mischief that we get into when we talk about vestigial organs. Well, if it's doing anything, it's not vestigial. No, that's not what vestigial means. It just means it's not doing what it originally evolved for. So, for example, they have found that a lot of the non-coding junk DNA will bind proteins, and sometimes they will bind regulatory proteins. Now, critics of Maddock's position, of the ENCODE position, say, well, of course it does. With all of those base pairs, of course they're going to match short units of, you know, just by chance alone. They're going to do all sorts of things by chance. Just because it's not completely inert doesn't mean it's functional. You know, so from my reading, that does seem to be the majority position, that the ENCODE people are just not correct in this, that they are using a ridiculously broad definition of what it means to be functional. They are essentially making the vestigial fallacy, if you will. Yeah. So, you know, that DNA could be doing all sorts of stuff just because it's there, you know, and it's going to bind to stuff. It's going to affect the shape of the chromosomes. And also, here's the other thing, is it serves as raw material for later mutations and evolution. Okay, because it's sitting there. Of course, it's going to serve as raw material. That doesn't mean that's its function. You know, that's again also almost, that's almost also a hyper-adaptationalist argument that because something can be recruited to serve a function, that that's why it's there. That that's it, that is, it's, that it's not junk.
Right.
It's not vestigial. It's there for that later purpose to which it ultimately gets pressed. That's not, in my opinion, valid evolutionary thinking. Mm-hmm.
It was designed to be there.
Right. Well, that's what the creationists will take it that step further and
exactly.
say it was put there on purpose to serve as raw material for our evolution. Really? Okay.
So, Steve, you could cut – so then you could theoretically cut out that 90% of the DNA and you would not be able to make – notice any difference in the phenotype.
So that would be the ultimate test, wouldn't it?
Right.
So we haven't done that. I would love – to see that experiment. Imagine a human being whose DNA is only is 1/10 the DNA of a normal human being, and where all the excess stuff. It's like, have any of you guys written code, like basic or anything? Just any
sure,
code?
Of course.
And you you start
four two
start and... with something simple, and then you add some functionality here, and then you fix something over there, and then eventually you get this mess. You know, and it's just this completely rigged monstrosity. That's what our genome is. You know, if you went back, once you had the final result, if you went back and totally rewrote it from beginning to end, top to bottom, doing everything it did, it would be much more efficient, much tighter, much more designed, right? Top down. So you asked the question, what if we take out pieces of the
yes,
DNA? So while we haven't done the ultimate experiment of cutting out all 90% of what we think are non-coding DNA, because you know what? We don't know enough yet to know what that 90%
right,
is.
Right.
We know that it's
trial
about 90%.
And error.
But, they have done it. They have done it in mice where they would just whack out, you know, splice out huge sections of what appear to be junk DNA, and there appears to be no functional effect. And there are people in whom that happens as a mutation. It happens naturally. And, there appears to be no negative effect. So the evidence as far as we have, the evidence as far as we have is that if you remove junk DNA from the genome, there's no phenotypic effect.
Right.
What's your problem with that?
I second Bob's wait a second.
Yeah. My wait a second is, wait, there are people, you have to go give me a little bit more detail. There are people that where this is, it just happens naturally. Can you expand on that a little bit?
They have just a non-coding segment removed from not all of it, just one little piece.
Oh, tiny, tiny piece, 1%, less than a percent.
Yeah,
not like.
But
15%.
How do they find out if it doesn't have any effect?
Right,
because
are they gambling a little bit?
Because we sequence people's genes.
So they just happen to have their gene sequenced and.
Yeah.
So they do know where to cut it.
In animals, by experiment, in humans, by observation, removing apparent non-coding junk DNA, non-functional DNA, doesn't appear to have any detrimental effect on the organism. It'd be fun to see how far we can push that, though, experimentally. That's what I'm saying. So that's the story of junk DNA. It's interesting, but now it's become one of those science reporting memes that I despise every time. Any study showing any new regulatory function of non-coding DNA, it's the end of junk DNA, and it's all nonsense. All right, let's take a quick break from our show to talk about one of this week's sponsors, GoToMeeting.
I was just in a GoToMeeting at work the other day, guys.
How did it go?
It went really well. A lot of people calling in from various places, and they were not technically savvy at all, these people, and they got it to work in about 10 seconds, so... That said a lot for the product.
Yeah, it's definitely really easy to use.
Even Jay can use it.
Even I can use it. And it helps me pronounce words. It's just the best online collaboration tool that we can have in the office. And the other awesome thing about it is that it has something called HD faces or, you know, HD video conference, meaning that everything can be broadcast in high def. The pictures are great. It just looks like you're watching a movie of everybody.
And you can do it from a Mac or a PC or a smartphone or a tablet.
Yeah, it's really convenient. You know, it's on the go, impromptu, last minute meetings. We've been using it a lot now for the SGU. So GoToMeeting by Citrix. You can get started in seconds from your computer or mobile device just by signing up for a 30-day free trial, no credit card required to get started. So visit GoToMeeting.com, and when you do, please use the promo code SGU. That way you'll get your 30-day free trial, and the SGU will get credit for sending you there.
That's gotomeeting.com, promo code SGU.
Evan, I wonder what the genome of those Martian lizards look like, which are not mammals, by the way.
Martian news this week. Unfortunately, well, we cover both science and pseudoscience when it comes to Mars. This particular one has to do with pseudoscience. Courtesy of Scott C. Warren from the reputable website, UFOs Sightings Daily. And the headline reads, Iguana Found on Mars by NASA Curiosity Rover.
Oh, my God.
Was it at least a giant iguana? Like, can it just be really huge or something cool like that?
It's interesting because when you look at pictures of the Martian surface and all, and there are hundreds, there are perhaps thousands of pictures to look at from Curiosity's cameras that, you know, have been snapping away since it arrived. It's really hard to gauge scale because you really don't have anything to measure it against, anything, you know, no measuring stick or a ruler or anything. So yeah, scale is tough. Regardless, and I know you guys have taken a look at the picture, there is something on the planet that might maybe look sort of like, an iguana.
There's something on the wing.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a cool picture. You know, it is a rock. It looks like a rock, and it is a rock. But it's a very fun and almost uncanny example of pareidolia.
It's not a calcified iguana, Steve, from an ancient, you know, waterbed.
Yeah, petrified.
That's what they're saying. It's a petrified iguana.
Petrified with its eyes open. That's remarkable.
Yeah. And stuck in a pose. It was clearly turned to stone by a Medusa. Okay, let's get that.
Or a basilisk.
Mars Medusa.
Basilisk could have done it too.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and say it doesn't look like a lizard.
It would kind of be missing its paws, right? I mean, it looks maybe like part of its legs fell
and its
off or
tail,
something. But, you know,
and its tail.
It looks
the head.
Nothing
I mean,
like
you look
a
at
lizard.
The head.
It really
what about
doesn't.
The back
you guys are way overselling this. This, it looks like a rock.
Rebecca?
It looks like
the
a rock.
The scientists over at UFO Sightings Daily are telling us that this is not the first animal found on Mars. There have been 10 to 15 others to date.
The scientists. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not only does this have a body, but if you look closely, you will see its lower neck skin, you know, that kind of, what do they call that on a turkey? The
waddle.
The waddle.
The waddle, the equivalent, whatever an iguana has. And look at its nostril hole and even, you know, the open eye. You know, how can you can't fake that.
No, all you have to do is look at thousands of rocks until you see one that accidentally resembles anything.
Exactly.
I miss when things look like Jesus. Can we go back to when things look like Jesus?
No, cool.
Those are simple.
And there's
times.
They have another lizard picture, Evan, too.
Yeah, earlier this year, in May, that somebody noticed in one of the photos, a lizard, a profile of a lizard. Long tail and everything. You can see kind of how its head is shaped and, you know.
But also, I mean, the thing that's compelling about this rock is that it appears to have these two legs, you know, on one side, so as if it were a four-legged creature. But, the tail is not there. The tail doesn't exist. It's not part of the rock. It's just an optical illusion. It's just a scratch in the ground. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, it's not a creature with a tail. It's a rock, and then there's this optical illusion of a tail behind it. And again, it's just all pareidolia. It's just your eyes just bringing it all together.
These guys' minds must be blown every time they go outside and look at the clouds.
Yeah.
Whoa, it's a lizard in the sky.
Plus I think
the sky.
Yeah.
Steve, I've got a problem with the whole
with diamonds.
Back end of this LSD. Lizard rock. The whole near end, the whole it's obviously really kind of messed up. Yeah, the head's impressive. But the back end is clearly a mess. And of course, I would love to see this at another angle. It's a whole face on Mars.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing. You're right. Another angle would be crap.
Would totally
Bob,
rip it apart.
Maybe the lizard dropped its tail before it got frozen by the Medusa.
Yeah, Bob, come on.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, how could I
or
listen to that?
That Bigfoot walked by and broke off its tail. That's what happened.
And clearly lizards can survive in an atmosphere that's, 1% that of Earth's atmosphere and about 25% of its gravity. So no discontinuity there whatsoever, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's suggested perhaps that NASA is secretly placing animals into these rovers and things that we send
why
to
not?
Mars. In order,
yeah.
Why not?
Because if we are going to eventually get to Mars, it would be, with people, and we eventually will, it'd be nice to have a little experiment and see, you know, exactly how animals, you know, fare on
the That's actually what drives the rover is hamster wheels inside running. And so every now and again, the animals get loose. Whoops.
Now, you want to go for the real conspiracy end of things? You have people, you know, certainly there are several interesting comments out there about this, including those that believe that this is proof that we never sent the rovers to Mars. You see, these are all photos from the Earth, and it is all part of a grand conspiracy to make us believe that NASA has the technology and know-how to actually get these things to Mars.
Because they accidentally take pictures of rock iguana.
But not just rock iguana, there's lizard. Can you guys name some of the other things that have been supposedly seen on Mars? I made a little list of about a dozen things. Let's see how many you can get in 30 seconds. Go.
Well, I mentioned Bigfoot already. I know there have been trees.
Yes, trees, good.
Some kind of canals.
Canals, yep.
And those...
Kermit. Kermit the Frog.
Kermit the Frog, very good, Bob. Yep. That's on my list, too.
Kermit. The face on Mars.
The face on Mars, of course. One of the famous... You could also say pyramids. You have squirrels or rodents. The famous, yep.
Those.
Buildings, space stations, frogs, not just Kermit the Frog, but other frogs. A severed finger.
Cool.
Of all things. That's very interesting. And ice spiders.
Ice spiders. So. And the shadows. Don't forget the shadows. They buried their ships on Mars.
Oh, would now be a good time for me to make a quick correction on something I said earlier in the show?
Go ahead.
Doc Ellis threw a no-hitter. While on acid, not just a shutout. No hitter.
I have a correction to that story too.
Well, I'm just saying. And Snopes, you know, they did their research. They say it's true.
All right, Bob. So, is dark energy real? Come on, straighten me out.
Yeah. Dartmouth researchers have recently made the theories of the increasing expansion rate of the universe and dark energy even more compelling. By all but ruling out what some consider their main theoretical competition. And I hadn't even heard of this theory.
I had, but I always thought it was stupid.
Well, yeah, you were right.
It was like almost for completeness. It's like to be logically complete, we have to say that this other possibility exists, but nobody would possibly believe it, right? But well, go ahead and tell us what it is.
Yeah, some did. This competition was the theory that the cosmic expansion and dark energy were both mere illusions, an observational artifact caused by the fact that the Earth is in the center of the universe.
Right.
So that's pretty much it. So that was like, yeah, okay, here we go. I mean, you'd think that an Earth-centered view of the universe would be long dead, but hey, we still have creationists too, don't we? So it's not that surprising. But still, scientists sometimes need to address seemingly outlandish theories like this. And this one was somewhat compelling. Because it didn't require any new physics, which is probably the main thing it had going for it. And it especially did not require previously unknown energy that accounts for 3/4 of all the energy in the universe. So it had that going for it.
Yeah, but right. You know what? Occam is not in favor of that theory. I mean, if you're going to try to invoke an Occam's razor type of argument where we don't have to introduce any new laws of physics, yeah, we just have to assume that the Earth is at the center of the universe.
Yeah, and that's a big one. So. Yeah. So this latest incarnation of the special Earth principle, like I call it, is it's claimed that because the Earth is in this kind of low density void at the center of everything, gravity therefore causes an illusion of an accelerating expansion, acting as if there's some sort of weird dark energy force pushing everything away from each other. And we therefore, because of this theory, we therefore cannot extrapolate to the universe at large based on observations we make locally, which was pretty much the bottom line of this idea. So that was their contention. And so to examine this scientifically, Dartmouth researchers Robert Caldwell, professor of physics and astronomy and undergraduate physics major Nina Maximova, looked at the glow of radiation suffusing the universe, otherwise known as the CMB, cosmic microwave background radiation. They calculated precisely how that radiation would be affected if the Earth were at the center of it all. And their conclusion was, rather unsurprisingly, of course, that the glow does not behave in the way it must if we had, you know, such a privileged place in the cosmos. And that's essentially it. Game over for that theory. They really kind of really put a huge period at the end of that sentence. So there you have it. So really the only thing left to do now is to find out what the hell dark energy is, please. And I hope we find out, because I will be very frustrated if I die not knowing what the vast majority of the universe is made of.
Oh, that would suck, wouldn't it?
It's very important.
Well, they'll announce it a few days after, Bob, so.
Yeah. we'll announce it at your funeral.
Yeah, that's right. Newsflash.
That's funny. Like the day after they announce the news, I'm going to go through the obituaries for the day before and be like, you poor suckers. I mean, you just missed it. You could have known if you hung on for one more day.
Although not as bad as immortality discovered, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You got me there.
Bob, right. The mysteries drive us forward.
All right. Well, Evan, quickly get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
Yeah. So let's go ahead and play for you last week's Who's That Noisy as a reminder. Here we go.
Adorable.
That's a 10.
Oh my gosh.
Depends how you interpret it.
And Rebecca, you were right off the bat. Last week after we first played it, didn't make it to air. What would you like to tell people exactly what that was?
I know the sound of a porcupine eating a pumpkin when I hear it.
And apparently thousands of other listeners of the SGU do as well. Yeah. This one, boy. I'm going to have lots more emails coming in on this one that say, this is great. I finally know this. It's a porcupine. It's so cute. It's wonderful. Great. Yeah, it's exactly what it is.
A porcupine.
Who knew?
Everyone.
Rebecca.
Lots of correct answers, guesses. Aurora Gertz is this week's winner. Well done, Aurora.
Good job.
And you had it tough this week because your name went into the hat with, like I said, about 1,000 other people. So that was a tough draw this week to win. So extra congratulations to you. Now let's go ahead and play for you the noisy. Brand new, fresh off the presses from this week. Go ahead and figure out who this is. Here we go.
This is the century of biology. Physics has had its good time. But now it's going to be biology.
What do you think about that, Bob? He's telling the physicist, yeah, you had your day. Now it's biology's turn.
We shall see. I think it's going to be the century of artificial intelligence.
He's always been a bit full of himself.
It's a little early in the century to tell, but.
Give it a best guess who that is. WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the email, or posted on our message boards, sguforums.com. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. One quick email this week. This is just a correction from last week from the Science or Fiction, actually. This one comes from Tim Farley. You guys know Tim, right?
Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tim.
Tim writes,
Farley.
Paul Rayburn at the Night Science Journalism points out that several news stories on that knee ligament actually got it wrong, that it was discovered. I almost made it. That it was discovered in 1879. But what the new study shows is what it is for. And he gives a link to the details. The source of the confusion was a poorly written press release. Okay, so this is the situation. Last week, one of the science fiction items was the fact that orthopedic surgeons have discovered a new ligament, the anterior lateral ligament of the knee. And that was how the press was reporting the story, spurred on by the press release describing it as such. And I mentioned, because I did actually go and look at the study, that, and this was also mentioned, but although I think misleadingly, I agree, in the press release, that the, in 1879, a French surgeon did the press releases, and I think incorrectly said predicted the existence of this ligament, but in fact, he described the ligament, although he described a pearly resistant fibrous band at the anterior lateral aspect of the human knee. So here's the thing. I do think it's not unreasonable to say that the new description was a quote unquote discovery in the same way that Columbus discovered America, right? Yeah, there were already people living here and the Vikings were here before he was, but he quote unquote discovered it in a way that sort of entered it into at least European knowledge in a way that it never had to be rediscovered. In this case of this ligament, you know, something was described in, you know, a fibrous band at that part of the knee. It was kind of lost to medical knowledge until the 1970s when it was again discussed, and there were studies, you know, looking for it, even describing it. And, but it wasn't really completely fleshed out as, yes, here it is, the anterior lateral ligament. You know, this is what it is. Here's all the characteristics until this recent study. And so it has brought it over a threshold into official anatomical medical knowledge. Probably not accurate to say discovery, because then it makes it seem like we had no idea it was there. Sort of like, oh, what's this? You know, but, yes.
I'd never seen that before.
You know, the fact that there was something there was previously known. So yeah, I've heard some scientists discussing it as a rediscovery, which is reasonable because, you know, again, it wasn't totally unknown previously. Anyway, that's the only correction for last week. And now a quick break to hear this.
Fox Sunday. Don't miss the world premiere of Almost Human. In the year 2046, Detective John Kennex was ambushed and left for dead. Now, as he returns to the Force, it will take a machine.
I'm Dorian.
Are you a robot?
Yes, I am.
I'm not driving with one of those things.
To bring him back to life.
I can't say that I was born, but I was made to feel.
Fantastic. I get the synthetic with the bleeding heart.
Almost Human, premiering Sunday on Fox.
We are joined now by Gerald Posner. Gerald, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Very nice to be back. Thank you for having me.
And Gerald is an award-winning journalist and author, author of 11 books now. Is that correct?
Yes. As a matter of fact, sometimes I forget, and I have to look up at the wall and figure out whether it's 11 or 12. It's a bad sign, right?
But we mostly want to talk to you this evening about one book in particular, Case Closed, published in 1993, about the JFK assassination, because we're coming up just next Friday after the show airs on the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to believe. I mean, I thought when, you know, I published the first time on the 30th anniversary that it seemed a long way in the rearview mirror back to that day in Dallas on November 22nd, 63. Now it's remarkable that we're turning the half century mark on it. I talked to a professor at Southern Methodist University the other day who's been teaching a class for 20 years on the assassination. He says that his students now who come in, to them, it's so far back. It's like Pearl Harbor to those of us who grew up.
It's ancient history now.
Yeah, it really is. And when he recently asked them in a class last year to go ahead and get from their family recollections of what it was like on the day, they came back not with their parents' recollections, these are college students, but with their grandparents' recollections. So, boy, did I start to feel old.
Wow.
That'll do it.
Yeah.
But the event, I think it still resonates. I mean, it has such a huge historical impact, I think, on the American psyche, don't you think?
It does. I think, you know, it's my pop psychology on this, and it's hard to figure out exactly what's right. But in part, it's because it's the Kennedys. I'm not sure this is... Some people take offense if I say that I don't think it would be quite this big if it was Gerald Ford or Jimmy Carter, but I don't think it would be. It was a television assassination, the home movie of the assassination, the Zapruder film. It looks like a Hollywood movie with Jackie with her pink pillbox hat and JFK coming down the street. Ruby's Murder of Oswald certainly makes it big. And then I think that Oliver Stone, a very good filmmaker, just a terrible historian, gets the credit for re-energizing it for at least that generation in the 90s and kicks it off again, so that it does have a special hold, it seems.
Yeah, and there I think is an enduring conspiracy subculture, and the JFK assassination is still in the top five. I mean, it still comes up in every conspiracy venue.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's in some ways... And you know this from the skeptic's end, it's hard to determine what's really the mother of all conspiracies. But certainly the JFK conspiracy, while not the first, is what I call that major modern age conspiracy, just predating a series of things that caused a tremendous loss of faith in the American public and their government and set the groundwork for even crazier conspiracy theories. So that you have JFK... And then you have Watergate and Vietnam, the lies over Vietnam and Watergate and Iran-Contra. So we learned that the government, the disclosures in the 70s about Contralpo, the FBI efforts, the illegal efforts against Martin Luther King and others in the left. So we learned that the government can and does plot against the best interests of the American people at times. They aren't very good at doing it. They're more the Keystone Cops than the James Bonds of the world. So invariably those conspiracies unravel over the years. But still, it fills people with the idea that terrible things are done by a secret cabal in Washington. For some reason, many people seem to believe that the very same government that cannot build a homeless shelter on budget or in within a schedule.
Or a website.
Or a website, right, as we now know on the marketplace for healthcare, can somehow, when they're doing something nefarious, not just do it well, but do it perfectly. They pulled off a crime 50 years ago, if you believe that, that nobody can solve. There's no trace of there's little bits of evidence here and there, but nothing that, you know, proves it. And I will tell you that not only as a political science major from years ago, but as somebody who has dealt with government and ex-government officials and intelligence officials over the years in different books, they are well-intentioned for the most part, but they are often more the Keystone Cops than the James Bonds of the world. And they don't get it right, unfortunately. They didn't know the Shah of Iran was about to fall 24 hours before he fell in Iran years ago. We know that, in fact, the highest echelons of the CIA and the biggest dons of the mafia were, in fact, working together in the early 60s to kill a head of state. It just wasn't Kennedy, it was Castro. And 24 times they were unable to even wound them. So, you know, somehow those same two groups that somehow couldn't kill Castro, they really wanted him out. The CIA didn't want a communist 90 miles from our border, and the mob wanted their casinos back. They couldn't pull that off. Somehow pulled off the perfect crime in Dallas. I just don't think so.
Yeah, I often think that as well, that people often have a childlike view of institutions, whether it's medicine or the government or whatever, and they almost like a child views an adult, like they have some unbelievable level of mastery over what's going on. And then when you actually learn how it functions, you realize that everyone is a child, that nobody has control over what's going on. Everyone's just regular people with all their flaws and their limitations. And, you know, yeah, that kind of grand conspiracy would collapse under its own weight because no one is that good.
That's right. And that's what I think what you said there is very interesting. No one is that good. It doesn't mean that they couldn't have the bad intent to try something that was truly terrible. But if we were 5 years out from the assassination, I don't know if I'd say without any question at all, I'd lean to thinking it's Oswald, but I'd say, you know, maybe we should wait a little while. Maybe there's a deathbed confession coming up, or there's a bit of evidence we don't know, or something's coming out of Mexico City and Oswald's visit just, you know, a month and a half before the assassination, or maybe something will come out of Russia eventually about his stay there. But 10 years later, 15 years later, after the Garrison fiasco of the district attorney in New Orleans was made into a hero in Stone's film, 20 years later, now we're 50 years on. And, you know, there's not a piece of evidence. The ballistics and the scientific evidence has come in to show that the Warren Commission, which had to guess at some things like the so-called magic bullet, got it right. So, you know, we're looking at this 5 decades on, but still people are unwilling to give up that core belief that there must be something else.
You don't think there's any mysteries out there waiting to be revealed at this point in time?
Boy, I'll tell you, I just put out Case Closed in an ebook for the first time in 20 years. The book has a new foreword, which I don't want to blow it for potential readers, but essentially the new foreword just says Case Still Closed. It ruins my 2,000-word foreword. But the book itself is unchanged. It wasn't updated. Nothing was changed or corrected. Now, I could have added in more. I put into the foreword what happened in a very brief sense, what happened in the last 20 years in terms of the hundreds of thousands of pages of new documents and some of the KGB agents who came out and talked and some of the Cubans who came out and said he was here in Mexico City and we thought he, meaning Oswald, was a nutcase. But there's nothing that changed any of the conclusions or text that I had back in 1993. That's rather remarkable because it's hard to imagine doing a book without having to make some correction and say, okay, guy, you know, that footnote was wrong. He wasn't at the Ford dealership. He was at the Chevy dealership. And I don't mean it was perfect, but the case hasn't changed in that sense. Nothing's come out that's changed it.
So let's talk a little bit about the book, because I was very impressed. I did read the whole book. I was very impressed by it. The fact that I think early on you make the point that so many books were written about the JFK conspiracy, but nobody did what may be the obvious thing, which is look at Oswald himself. Everyone just assumed he didn't do it and looked in other directions. But you were like, let's see if we could build a case that Oswald actually killed Kennedy. And I think you very convincingly go on to do that.
Well, you know, it's to me, if you ask me what's the key to the case, I'm not going to talk to you about the ballistics. I'm not going to talk to you about bullet angles or the autopsy or anything that, you know, that most people focus on in Dealey Plaza. To me, the key to the case is Oswald. And the reason for that is if you study Oswald as a researcher, an investigator, as, you know, anybody looking at this, and you don't feel at the end of that study that you understand why JFK died in Dallas on November 22nd of 63, then there's something missing. If the person you study isn't the assassin, forget whether he pulled the shots off, whether he could or that, just the personality of that individual. Is he or is he not the assassin? Is there an understanding as to why he killed the president? It's one of the things the Warren Commission failed to give us. And that's why really the first third of the book is essentially a biography of Oswald. It's understanding how this kid, you know, we overuse the word dysfunctional nowadays. We overuse the word genius. Everybody's a genius. Everybody has a dysfunctional background. But to the extent that Oswald, you know, moved 21 times by the time he was 16, 11 different schools. And at the, when he was 13 in New York City, we had something extraordinary with him, which we never usually have on somebody accused of being an assassin. We had a psychiatric exam. He was a truant from school. They gave him 3 weeks of mandatory psychiatric evaluation, and they concluded he was passive aggressive with schizoid features, and the diagnosis was mandatory psychiatric care in a home, and his mother took him back to Texas instead. You know, nowadays we look for these red flags for the people who may be a Columbine shooter or maybe an Aurora shooter or Sandy Hook. In this instance, in 1953, he slipped through the cracks. You know, he goes into the Marine Corps thinking at 17 it's going to change his life because he hates what's going on. It's an unmitigated disaster. He's court-martialed twice. He shoots himself with an unregistered gun. He punches an officer in the face. He's studying Russian. They think he's a quirky guy. They think he's gay. Many of his fellow Marines, they throw him in the shower. They call him Mrs. Oswald. The only thing he's good at is on the target range. You know, he's a sharpshooter, the second highest in the Marine Corps. He hits 212 once, which means he can hit a 10-inch target like 8 times out of 10 from 200 feet. But he's a guy who's not very happy. And when he finally goes to Russia in 59, he thinks it's going to change his life again. And the Russians tell him to leave. They think he might be an American spy. He slits his wrist. And what do we get? A second psychiatric evaluation on him within a 6-year period. And they conclude he's nuts. So, you know, when he comes back to America, he starts hammering and battering Marina. Most people don't know this. For a year and a half, she leaves him at one point. Another point, she tries suicide, and he catches her trying the suicide, and he beats her again. You go back on these people, and you know this. All of you have seen instances in which there's a shooting, and then a reporter goes to the neighborhood and says, you know, what was the person like? And they always say, oh, he's so great, so nice. He, you know, he's nice, petted the dogs, and water the flowers. We thought he was a nice person. The people on Oswald all said, you know, all the Russian emigres, we thought he had like a diseased mind. He was sick. There wasn't something right with him. And we forget that he tried to kill an army general, Edwin Walker, this right-wing army general. That was going to be his contribution to history. So he's a very unusual, at the time of the assassination, just turned 24-year-old sociopath.
Mm-hmm. So I agree that you make a compelling case that, you know, Oswald's history, it's like an arrow pointing right at, you know, putting him in that sniper's nest with a gun pointed at Kennedy. But the forensic evidence all lines up as well. I mean, there were independent analysis, the failure analysis group, for example. What in there did you find the most compelling? And how is it, we'll segue to another topic, how is it that the conspiracy theorists maintain their theories in the face of this overwhelming physical evidence, or at least what we have, is all pointing in one direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, as a matter of fact, coming up on Wednesday, there's a NOVA documentary that's going to take the failure analysis work and advance it even further in terms of where the science is, showing, I think, conclusively, again, that even if you want to take Oswald out of the equation, there's no doubt in my mind that the only credible evidence forensically and ballistically shows that the shooter who hit the president that day and Governor Connally was firing from behind the motorcade and from the general direction of the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, using Oswald's gun to the exclusion of every other gun in the world. So even if you had the world-class assassin out there, they were firing with Oswald's weapon from behind, and that's how the president was hit. No grassy knoll shooter, nobody from the front, none of the Oliver Stone stuff. The so-called magic bullet needed no magic. It happened as the Warren Commission thought it must have, and now you can prove it. So that, you know, that's the floor on which half a dozen of Oswald's co-workers left him 30 minutes before the assassination, from which his palm print, his fingerprints were found on the stock of the rifle and around all of the boxes from where the sniper's nest was set up. But more than that, it goes back to what you were saying a second ago, which is understanding Oswald. This is a guy who, no matter what else you want to say about him, he was politically active. He had a sort of a form of leftist anarchism. This wasn't straight Marxism or communism. He could have been the Oswald that I came to understand could have been on the sixth floor of a building in downtown Moscow shooting at Nikita Khrushchev. He was going to throw a cog into the machinery of government, and this was Kennedy was a golden opportunity for him. But here's a guy who's on the streets of New Orleans only weeks before handing out leaflets for Castro. Whether you think he's pro-Castro or is a fake and he's anti-Castro, he learns of the assassination that day, and he's the only employee at the book depository who's not there when they do a roll call 45 minutes later. When they asked him, the police asked him later, why did you leave? He said, well, somebody told me the president had been shot, so I thought, oh, well, we must have the rest of the day off, so I just went home. That's so the opposite of what this politically active mind would have done. If he had heard the president had been shot and had nothing to do with it, he would have been out there in Dealey Plaza asking people what had happened, finding out what it was about, going to the place where the president was. Instead, what he does is he gets on a bus to go back to his boarding house. The bus is slow. He then takes a taxi, which, by the way, may not seem unusual to you or your listeners, but it's extraordinary. He has so little money and was such a penny pincher. A taxi was the first time in his life that we know of him taking a taxi. He gets to the boarding house. He gets his pistol and a jacket and then runs into a police officer a few minutes later and shoots him dead with 5 shots. So, it's all the signs of flight. Even people who think he had nothing to do with the assassination, I just sort of throw my arms up. I just don't understand that.
So you've recently debated Blakey in Vegas.
Right.
So tell me about that. What was his position? Because he seems to be somebody who has at least encyclopedic knowledge of the event, but still is holding out for the multiple shooter hypothesis. So how does he put his case together?
He puts it together like this. I ended up liking Blakey. I interviewed him in 92, but it was a telephone interview. So I've never met Blakey. And I ended up liking him much more than I expected because he was entrenched in his position, but he's very logical about it. So that he believes that Oswald was the only shooter at Dealey Plaza who hit anybody, and that the 3 shots came from behind. The magic bullet happened, as I believe it did, as a single bullet that hit both Kennedy and Connolly, and the headshot is exactly what we all know it was, that fatal shot at frame 313 that blew out the front portion of the president's head. Okay. He believes that Oswald shot Tippett and that Oswald shot at Walker and that Oswald is not balanced and all of that. His conspiracy comes in the following. He still clings to the sound recordings off of a tape recording that the House Select Committee in the late 70s thought might have belonged to a motorcycle policeman who was in Dealey Plaza, and these 2 sound experts had picked up 4 impulses around the time of the shots. They believe those impulses may have been supersonic, like bullet sounds, although you can't hear anything. And Blakey therefore thinks that a 4th shot was fired from the direction of the grassy knoll before the headshot, just before the headshot. And he admits that that bullet missed. But the fact that there was another shooter there means a conspiracy. And I must tell you that he's so logical and has so much common sense until that point, because that means that you have a second shooter at the grassy knoll. Because the conspiracy, whatever the conspiracy is, can't trust Oswald to make the shots from the rear. So therefore, the world-class assassins at the front, he fires and misses everybody. He doesn't hit Kennedy or Mrs. Kennedy or Connolly or Mrs. Connolly or the Secret Service agents in the front seat. He doesn't hit the people standing on the other side of the car. He doesn't hit the car itself. That's the real magic bullet. It disappears entirely at Dealey Plaza. So the idea that there was a second shooter, we can't hear the sound. It's some subsonic impulse on a sound tape, which now I think has been proven pretty conclusively not to have been at Dealey Plaza on a motorcycle, but actually at the Trademark a couple of miles away. I think Blakey just can't give that up because it was the conclusion of the Select Committee. He was the chief investigator for it as counsel and is somehow attached to his DNA.
Yeah, that's just the one thread he's holding on to and won't let go.
Yeah. And he said to me, it was very interesting at one point afterwards, he said, we only said 95, well, not only, he didn't mean it that way, but we said 95%, meaning that even if everything the select committee said was correct, there was a 5% chance that they were wrong. All right, completely wrong. I mean, people hit the lottery at much worse odds than that. So what he was saying is, maybe we got it wrong. You know, even we admitted that, that there was a small chance for that.
But isn't there a point where it comes that we can actually never, never really prove that there was anybody else? If you're going to be going on evidence that is that flimsy, that relies on, you know, that weak a thread, I think an argument could be made that, you know, if there ever was somebody else, there is no evidence that exists that will ever tie someone else to it.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's no other evidence that will tie anyone to it. But the thing is, I think, you know, as well, part of the confusion over the Kennedy assassination in particular is that people assume that, or many people make this assumption, that since groups of people wanted the president dead, and they may have conspired to actually take some steps to killing him, maybe the mob did. I wouldn't be surprised if you were able to give me a tape recording of Marcello and a couple of other mafia mobsters who hated Kennedy sitting around a table saying, let's get rid of that no good SOB, and maybe even taking some steps to killing him. They think that because those groups wanted the president dead and then Oswald killed him, that Oswald must have acted for those groups. It must be a conspiracy. My challenge to those conspiracy theorists over time, and even to Blakey, who thinks it could be the mob, is you've got to tie Oswald in. And the key to this isn't, it's not a broad test. This becomes a very specific test. Oswald was left New Orleans on September the 25th in the middle of the day on a Continental Trailways bus that started a two-day trip to Mexico City. He got into Mexico City, three bus changes later, went to Houston, then another bus, and an overnight bus, a Mexican bus to Mexico City. He gets in on the morning of the 27th. He's trying to get down to Havana because he thinks that's where the new revolution is. On September the 26th, while Oswald was on his way down there, the White House announced for the first time that JFK was going to have a trip to Texas. They didn't announce the city yet, but he was going to Texas. But that means that nowhere in Oswald's life before the 26th of September could anyone have involved him, Kennedy, and a plot in Texas. So the plotters, if they brought Oswald in, had to do it after he returned to Dallas, when he was rejected by the Cuban and Soviet missions in Mexico City, returned to Dallas in early October. They've got 6 weeks, a little over 6 weeks, to bring him in. Now, they can't do it by telepathy. You know, it's not like science fiction. They can't just send him the message. So you've got to show me in those 6 weeks how they did it. And the great thing about Oswald is he wasn't living alone. He was living, his wife was out living with a friend, Ruth Payne, in a suburb of Dallas, and he was living in a boarding house with six other guys who were interviewed extensively by the FBI and the police afterwards, who said he never had a visitor. He never went out at night. He used to stay pretty much to himself. He'd make a telephone call like once a day in a foreign language. That sounds really interesting until you find out it's to Marina and he's talking to her in Russian. And they have all the toll calls. So bringing Oswald into the plot is, I think, the greatest obstacle. That's the one that conspiracy theorists really can't overcome.
But what you're doing is trying to say, to put onto conspiracy theorists the burden of demonstrating an actual conspiracy, but that's often not how they operate. They operate by simply poking holes in the standard story and
right.
saying that therefore what you have left is a conspiracy.
That's absolutely right. It's very interesting because I almost never get a counter story of what happened. Nobody ever says, okay, not only do I think there's a conspiracy, but let me tell you how it happened. Instead, if you press a conspiracy theorist to say, how did it happen? They say, it's not up to me to prove that. I don't have to tell you how it happened. The government should find that out. I just have to tell you it's a conspiracy.
Well, Gerald, always a fascinating discussion. We love having you on the show. Thanks for giving us your time.
To skeptics, I love talking to skeptics because we aren't skeptical enough as a society. So I'm
absolutely.
We're too accepting. So, you know, keep up the good work of questioning everything.
Thanks a lot. All right, everyone. Let's take a quick break to talk about this week's sponsor, Hulu Plus.
I love Hulu Plus. This week, I've been really into a little TV movie from 1984 you might have heard of called The Toughest Man in the World, Mr. T's first starring role in a made-for-TV movie.
Is that right?
As a bouncer with a heart of gold who hangs out with a bunch of little kids. And, you know, some reviews will say that this one's for Mr. T fans only, which is everybody. Am I right?
Right? Rebecca, maybe you watched it on Apple TV or Sony PlayStation 3 or your Wii or your Microsoft Xbox. There are so many different ways to watch Hulu Plus.
I've watched it on all of those things, actually. All of them.
Did I mention that War Games, the movie, is available on Hulu Plus?
That's the one with Matthew Broderick?
Yeah.
Broderick?
Broderick?
Broderick.
Broderick. Of the Broderick Institute?
And you can get Hulu Plus for just $7.99 a month, or you can check it out for free for 2 weeks if you go to huluplus.com/SGU. Use the SGU promo code to get your 2 week free trial and to also give the SGU credit for sending you there.
Or you can go to our homepage at www.theskepticsguide.org and click the link.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. But of course, this week we have a theme and we have four items. Evan is 100% entirely to blame for this theme this week.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll
the
be here all
week. Is porcupines.
Ha-ha. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Bastard.
Here
Advantage
we go.
Me.
Item number one. New world porcupines, like new world monkeys, have prehensile tails they use to climb trees. Item number two. While porcupines cannot shoot their quills, some species can throw them a short distance by whipping their tails. Item number three. A recent study documented porcupines killing dogs, foxes, and even badgers with their quills. And item number four, porcupine quills are coated in a natural antibiotic. And of course, Evan, you have the privilege of going first.
Oh, well, thank you very much. New world porcupine. Prehensile tails? Seems a little too coincidental. I guess, is a porcupine going to, why would a porcupine climb a tree? Would it climb it to find food? Would it climb to find protection? I don't think protection. It's already got built-in protection. So I'm not sure what would be the purpose of that? Why would it head to the trees that way? So I don't know. The next one, porcupines cannot shoot their quills, unlike the cartoons I've seen in my life, but some species can throw them a short distance by whipping their tails. Okay, you know, look, if you're going to whip something around enough and you've got things that are, you know, will come off. I imagine they shed their quills and grow new ones. Yeah, you're going to get a couple stragglers. And yeah, short distance. Yeah, probably more of a accident sort of thing rather than a real defense mechanism. Or maybe they adapted to be a defense mechanism. I think that one's right. The next one, the porcupines killing dogs, foxes, and badgers with their quills. Well, I don't know about this one because when you say killing, it's almost like they're using their quills intentionally as a weapon of offense rather than one of defense. The last one, the porcupine quills coated in a natural antibiotic. Yeah, okay, so it secretes something that gets on the quills. I gotta put my nickel down. Perhaps the tail one, there's a reason for the tail that I'm just not seeing there. And I'm gonna say that it is the killing one. I don't think they go on the offense that way. It's a defensive mechanism. So the killing of dogs, foxes, and badgers with the quills is fiction.
Okay, Bob?
The antibiotic on the quills, I don't know. My first thought was why would there be anything that would help the animals that get impaled on it? But then I was thinking perhaps the antibiotic would help if it accidentally impales itself. If it could even do that. Documented killings. Evan, my first thought here is that not that the porcupine is charging, but some silly animal is just like mindlessly attacking and biting and getting impaled on these. So I could see how that would happen, the antibiotic notwithstanding. So let's see, shooting the quills.
I'm wounded, but yeah, I don't have an infection. Yay.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I have a problem with this one. Wasting their time whipping their tails in hope of discouraging an attack. I can't imagine any accuracy at all, and I don't like the idea of porcupine throwing these quills out. I know they've got a lot of them, but I can't. You know, I'm sure it takes a while to grow back something like that. But I think I might have the biggest problem with the prehensile tails. I mean, how much help could that be getting up to a branch, first of all? And then I just can't see porcupines hanging out in trees. I could see it perhaps, you know, hanging from a branch, possibly with a prehensile tail, but actually helping it climb, I'm just not seeing it. I don't think it's long enough to do that to really be helpful. So I guess for those reasons, I'm going to say that the prehensile tail is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
Here's the thing. Porcupines definitely hang out in trees. My problem is I don't know what distinguishes New World porcupines from other porcupines. So I'm pretty sure that all porcupines hang out in trees. But I don't know. And I also know that some porcupines have prehensile tails. Well, I don't know, but I'm like pretty sure. But I don't know if that's the New World variety because I do not know anything about porcupines, species.
You know what they sound like when they eat a pumpkin?
I do know exactly what they sound like when they eat a pumpkin. And if that had been included in this, porcupines make an adorable noise while eating pumpkins, I would have been like, that one is science. for that reason, just because I don't know if the details are quite right on that one, that is suspect. Porcupines, I know it's correct that they cannot shoot their quills, but I have heard before that they can whip their tails and throw quills that way. I don't know if that turns out to be some well-known myth that I unknowingly bought into, because I've never actually seen it happen, but I'm pretty sure that one's science. It seems odd that a porcupine would be able to kill a dog, a fox, or even a badger on a regular basis, because, as Evan said, I don't think that's what their quills are for. They're just run away from me and not die, because porcupines don't eat those things. But I can certainly see an instance, like, if one of those animals were to bite down on a porcupine, I can see how a spine, a quill, might go, like, through in their face into their brain.
Yeah.
That could happen. So, or if they like swallow a bit of a quill or something, maybe it can gouge them from the inside. So I think it's the sort of thing where maybe it's rare, but this just says it's documented, which means that, yeah, it's rare, but it happens, which I can believe. And then porcupine quills being covered in a natural antibiotic is not something I've ever heard of. And I was going to go with that one as the fiction, but Bob made a good point about being a protection for when they fall and hurt themselves. But that seems weird. Like, are porcupines so clumsy that they need that at the cost of, like, helping the things they're trying to drive away? But then again, an antibiotic wouldn't make quills hurt any less, so it would still maintain the advantage of driving away predators. So it's between that one and the prehensile. I know, I'm pulling a Bob.
Caveat.
I'm pulling a Bob.
It's okay. We understand.
What did you go with? Well, maybe I should just GWB on this one.
Yes, of course you should. Prehensile fiction.
The tails.
And Evan, what did you go with?
I went with the killing of dogs, foxes, and badgers. Killing, because I interpret killing to mean intentional.
Yeah. I don't think that's true. So I'm going to GWB it. I'm going to say the prehensile tail thing, but only because I think that Steve has monkeyed with the details.
Uh-huh. I get it. Steve's in the thing.
He's porcupined with the details.
Steve, do me a favor. Just send me that audio snippet where Rebecca says, Bob, what'd you go with?
All right, Jay.
All right. Well, this first one about the prehensile tails, I have an absolute memory of a children's book with a porcupine hanging in a tree.
Thank you.
Therefore, that one is science. Thank you. The second one about the porcupines that shoot their quills, I saw a cartoon as a child where porcupines were shooting their quills. That one is science.
Thank you.
And the last
one, that says porcupine. That they don't shoot their
porcupine. What?
Never mind. Just keep going. I don't want to.
No, I know, but just follow me. The last one, the porcupine quills are coated with natural antibiotic. I saw something as a child where a porcupine was squirting something out of its quills. That one is science. Porcupines do not kill large animals like dogs, foxes, or absolutely, and most importantly, angry badgers. The third one is the fake.
We don't even need a reveal.
Badgers don't care, though, Jay.
Jay and I are right. That's honey badgers.
Jay, did you ever read like Clifford the Big Red Dog or maybe books with talking animals?
Just yesterday.
Bob.
So those are science.
All right. When you're mean, you have nothing else to draw on.
Yeah, okay. You go
with what you got, baby.
Rebecca, what does a fox say?
Ding, 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 and ding, and ding, I think.
Thank you.
No, foxes say, farley, 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 la farley.
So you guys all agree that porcupine quills are coated in a natural antibiotic, and that one is science.
Yes.
Okay.
But none of you hit upon the reason why they are coated with antibiotics.
I don't care.
It's not because they're clumsy.
Moving on.
It's not so that in case they stick themselves with their own quills, which seems highly anatomically implausible.
Oh, their mate.
It's other porcupines.
Oh, they might stick...
Yeah, the porcupine concubine.
Nice.
And
pick a wicker, wow.
Probably wouldn't help it wouldn't reduce the effectiveness of the quills as a defensive deterrent.
Yes.
Yeah.
That whatever animal gets stuck won't die of an infection. All right. You also all agree that while porcupines cannot shoot their quills, some species can throw a short distance by whipping their tails. You all think that one is science as well. And that one is the science. Fiction.
Oh, no,
what?
It can't be.
No way.
Because
that's the fiction.
Thing.
Wow. No way.
Yeah, I got every single source I looked at said that they cannot project them in any way that an animal has to touch them. But they will then break off very quickly. They very easily will break off and stick in the animal. But they have to physically touch the porcupine. They have to make contact.
When I was a kid, I saw a cartoon where a porcupine picked up its tail like a gun and shot quills out of its tail.
Yeah, that's
That's the myth. But those quills are nasty. They're
awesome. I've held a whole bunch of them. Maybe there's different kinds, of course. Yeah. I saw ones that were perfectly smooth that women would use to wear in their hair.
So a lot of them have barbs on the end. They're very small. It's not like an arrow barb, but there's like, they're tiny little barbs all the way down. Almost like, looks like a pine cone or something. And when you zoom in on it, on magnification. And that accomplishes a couple of things. One is it helps the quill go through the skin. I saw one study where they found that a barbed quill will penetrate the skin with half of the force of a smooth quill.
Whoa.
And with less force than a hypodermic needle of the same size. So they penetrate very easily. But even worse than that, those barbs allow the quill, it makes it harder for them to pull out, but in addition, it means they can only move in one direction deeper in. So as the animal moves around, the quill works its way deeper and deeper into the tissue until it penetrates some kind of vital organ and kills it.
This is evil.
That's how they're so deadly. Maybe at first, if you can get it out, it's not too bad. But the longer it's in there, the more it works itself in, right? And sometimes animals will die from the trauma from, getting their lungs punctured or whatever. But sometimes, it just incapacitates them. If you're a predator and you have one of these things stuck in your paw and you can't get it out, you're not hunting for a while. You're probably going to starve to death. Which leads to number three. A recent study documented porcupines killing dogs, foxes, and even badgers with their quills. That one is science. Porcupines manage to kill even much bigger animals by sticking them with the quills. And yes, Evan, it is purely defensive. Porcupines are slow. They are easy to track. Their only defense is their quills. And some of the New World porcupines will bristle their quills so that they stand on end.
Look bigger.
Making them look much bigger. They also rattle their tail because their tail has a whole bunch of the hard, quills together. So they rattle it and for intimidation, and they grunt.
Awesome.
So imagine a porcupine grunting, rattling its tail and and putting up its quills. That's its trying to scare things away move. Typically, though, they also observed how the porcupine will fight. If it's faced off one against one creature, one on one, it'll just do the display and then try to hightail it out of there. If it's surrounded, though, or it's facing multiple enemies, then it will move sideways or backwards, and that's the way it will stick you with a quill.
Yeah, that's the direction they're going.
Because they face back. Yeah, they face backward, and they could put them up, but they can't point them forward. So they have to either back into you or move into the side and stick you that way. And they only do that when they're surrounded.
I'm going to back into you so hard.
All of this means that New World porcupines, like New World monkeys, have prehensile tails that they use to climb trees is science. And that was the most surprising thing I found about when I was researching porcupines. Yeah, so New World porcupines are smaller, and they climb trees, North and South America. They do that to just chill, to hide from enemies, and to eat, because they eat trees.
What? They eat trees?
Yeah, they eat bark.
Entire trees.
They eat bark. They eat bark, and they'll gnaw on twigs. And in the winter, they mostly eat bark. In the summer, they'll eat vegetation, leaves, and ferns, and stuff like that. They also really like to gnaw on anything salty. So probably you will. Your greatest chance of seeing a porcupine is when the roads are salted. And after a snowstorm,
awesome.
They'll come to the side of the road and lick the snow. They also will chew on anything that has pee in it sodium because of the salt.
Oh, they like the sodium. Yeah. Sure.
It outweighs the negative aspects of chewing on pee. The old world porcupines are much bigger, up to 40 pounds.
Whoa.
And those are the ones with the black and white quills, and they do not climb trees. So only the new world ones climb trees, mm-hmm. not the old world ones.
How do you weigh a porcupine?
Very careful.
All right. Well, Jay, finish things up with a quote for us.
Rob Bembridge from Sheffield, UK writes in an H.L. Mencken.
H.L. Mencken.
H.L. Puffin Stuff.
H.L. Puffin Stuff.
For every complex problem, there is an answer that is clear, simple, and wrong. H.L. Mencken.
I love that quote. I'm not sure we haven't used it before, but
whatever.
All right. Keeps us humble.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing.
It gets right at people's desire for simplicity. People want a clear, simple answer.
Sorry, folks. It's not the way the world works.
Yeah, it's not the way. I tell that to my daughters a lot. That's not the way the world works. All right. Thank you all for joining me this week. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you,
hey,
Steve.
Surely.
And until next week. This is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. And don't forget that this episode was brought to you by Hulu Plus. To sign up for your free trial of Hulu Plus and start watching your favorite shows right now, and for an extended free trial, go to HuluPlus.com/SGU, or just go to our homepage and there will be a link right there for you.